Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. This week, we'll be looking ahead to the upcoming parliamentary elections in Portugal and asking the big question: just 2 years after the socialists won an absolute majority, why is the country heading back to the polls? It is Sunday, the 3rd of March, 2024.
To be a president who seeks not to divide but unify.
Not now.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
It's time for a change in this country, my friends. A real change.
Let's keep moving.
Slava Ukraine!
And joining me, as always, from the other side of the world is my co-host Sam. Now, Sam, in Mauritius, we'll be recording this on the 4th of March, 2024. But this year is a little bit different, isn't it?
It is, yes. We, of course, gained an extra day this year. Did you do anything nice with your extra day?
I was spending a day at work, so nothing particularly memorable. What about yourself?
Likewise. So it seems neither of us put it to good use. I feel like the 29th of February should be a public holiday.
We usually sometimes disagree on policy position, but there'll be no argument on that from me. And kudos to all those countries with four fixed-year terms, because it means that there are politicians who have to spend an extra day campaigning compared to everybody else in withholding elections in other different years, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose neither of that applies to the countries we're talking about today, because Portugal might have a four-year term, but it's certainly not used it. And Indonesia, of course, is every 5 years. So here we are.
Here we are indeed. So before we talk all things Portugal, Sam, I think, as you hinted out just now, I wanted to turn our attention to an election that took place rather close to home. Well, certainly in my case. And Sam, the fact that we are talking about it now in early March suggests that it was a resounding first round victory for Prabowo Subianto in Indonesia, isn't it?
Yeah, it was indeed. We suspected that there might be a chance that Prabowo Subianto would either just sneak over that 50% threshold, or at least if they did have to head into a second round, that he'd be doing it with a pretty resounding lead over any nearest competitors. But what actually happened was his ticket alongside Gibran Rakabuming, who is the son of the outgoing president, Joko Widodo, absolutely routed the rest of the field, getting 58.8% of the vote together. The second place was actually Anais Baswedan and Muamin Iskandar, which was an independent ticket. They got 24.5% of the vote. So it was a 35-point lead, nearly, between first and second place. And then Ganjar Pranowo, who, funnily enough, is the presidential candidate for the party that propelled Joko Widodo into the presidency in the first place, the PDIP, they finished in third place on just 16.7% of the vote, which I'm sure we'll come to unpack, Chern, but is quite an almighty fall from where they predicted themselves to be even 6 to 12 months ago. So there's a lot to unpack there in a quite remarkable presidential election in Indonesia, but it was a general election. So Chern, before we unpack things, just wanted to whiz through the parliamentary election results because they're nonetheless interesting as well. Now, when we're expecting full declared counts within the next fortnight, but at the moment we've got two-thirds of the vote counted, and I think we have a pretty good sense of where this dust is going to settle on these results, which is that the PDIP, the party of Ganjar Pranowo's presidential ticket, and the party that propelled Joko Widodo into the presidency in the first place, look likely to have won these parliamentary elections with around 16.4% of the vote, which I know sounds low, but it's pretty typical of Indonesian general elections to have even the winning party within the mid to high teens. So that's why it sounds low, because it is, and it's normal, so don't be alarmed. Golkar, who did support the Prabowo ticket, have once again finished there or thereabouts within the top three in second place with 15.1% of the vote. Gerindra, the party of Prabowo Subianto, finished in third place with 13.3%. And then the rest of the vote went to a variety of smaller parties supporting a mixture of Anais Baswedan, Prabowo, and indeed Ganjar himself. But Chern, your reactions to these results?
Let's focus on the... I think it's worth meriting, and the reason why we talked about the parliamentary election results is I think it's worth exploring that disconnect between the parliamentary and presidential election results, which I can go to later in the podcast. But let's start on the presidential election front. I will confess, Sam, that I think I was a little bit surprised, not necessarily by the fact that he won and he won in the first round, because we did flag in our podcast that that was likely. But it does seem to be a bit of error on the opinion polls, which you not agree, Sam, because Prabowo significantly overperformed his polls to be closer towards 60% rather than the 50% threshold. And it seems as if the polls underestimated to a certain extent the PDIP ticket of Ganjar Pranowo, because he's finished significantly behind Anish Baswedan when in the opinion polls had predicted a much closer race. So I was surprised by the strength of the ticket of the Prabowo Subianto's ticket and the relative weakness of the PDIP ticket. But I think it speaks more to the fact that this was an election where people wanted continuity, isn't it? And whilst Joko Widodo himself did not necessarily endorse the candidate, I think it is a fair thing to say that it was viewed there was apparent support given by the outgoing Indonesian president Joko Widodo to support Prabowo. So for example, during the 75-day campaigning period, Joko Widodo gave up about 6.8 trillion rupiah, we're looking about $400 million in aid to 8 farmers affected by El Nino. And during this period as well, there was an 8% pay rise for all civil servants. So you had Joko Widodo seemingly giving his apparent support, and then you had Prabowo himself, who vowed to continue his Joko Widodo's social aid program and focus on infrastructure. And we talked about this in the preview. If you wanted a clearer signal of that Prabowo would be continuing with the Joko Widodo, look no further than the man he picked to be his running mate, which is Joko Widodo's eldest son. So I think what we can read into these results is that these results suggested the fact that the president with 80% approval rating was very much able to influence his results beyond what the opinion polls thought. Do you agree with that, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think if you're wanting an explanation of these results, I think you can't really look much further than Joko Widodo's role in this election, which, as we talked about in the preview, it is unusual in Indonesian politics that an outgoing president has that much influence going into a subsequent election, because officially slash unofficially, he will now be the first person who has effectively handpicked his replacement in Indonesian presidential election history since they were directly elected. So you do have to look at that. And given that Joko Widodo had 80% approval and you had around 70% of people asked say that they thought Indonesian democracy was in a good or very good place, it then meant that not only do you have an exceptionally popular president influencing the race, but even if you're a candidate who starts to critique that involvement or critique that interference, the rest of the Indonesian public, 70% of them, don't see any problem with that. They think democracy is pretty healthy. So even if you try to contest that, you saw the courts reject a bid to contest that because they ruled that Gibran could be on the ticket. And then you also had the public in opinion polls basically tacitly endorsing that interference as well. So that's, I think, it's very difficult, I think, to look beyond the role of the outgoing president and to understand why we have Prabowo Subianto as the president-elect of Indonesia and why it was done so decisively in one round.
Yeah, I think one thing you said there is key in terms of the health of Indonesian democracy and people's perception of it, because I think the context for some people would find it surprising why Indonesian democracy, why there's that view among Indonesians, considering Prabowo Subianto's past. Prabowo Subianto is a former special forces commander. He has a checkered human rights record and close ties, not only political ties to Suharto, one of Indonesia's former dictators, Suharto, who ruled Indonesia with an iron fist from 1967 to 1998. Prabowo has personal ties to Suharto, having previously married one of Suharto's daughters. But I think here's the key thing is you had that pass, but it is set against a backdrop where 52% of Indonesia's eligible voters are under 40 years of age. In other words, most Indonesians are therefore too young or were not born yet to understand much about the human rights allegations against Prabowo. So I think you had that disconnect between necessarily what a group with slightly longer memories remember, the older generation, and dare I say, probably a concern amongst the more educated older generations versus the vast majority of Indonesian youths, which are so much younger population, and where 35% of Indonesians did not finish elementary school, compared to only 6.4% of Indonesia's 275 million population who have a university diploma.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And the Prabowo ticket made no secret of trying to appeal to that younger generation, because Prabowo, alongside his exceptionally young by Indonesian political standards running mate in Gibran, who was just, I think, 36 years old, they had to go through the Supreme Court, as we talked about, to try and allow him to be eligible to run because of his age. They were really strongly appealing to the younger generation in Indonesia. They used social media quite effectively in this campaign. And I can't help but think that I don't think that entirely came from the Prabowo side, and actually Gibran's influence there would have been pretty essential to that campaign. But you did see them making pretty strong overtures to a younger generation, or a kind of middle-aged generation with young families, because one of their flagship policies throughout this campaign was that Prabowo talked about a nearly a $30 billion investment to provide free school meals, milk to school children, and infrastructure projects across the country as well. So you saw those direct overtures to that younger generation that I think is exactly the generation you're talking about, who are not hugely familiar with Prabowo's military past.
And exactly, I just want to unpack a few of the themes you talked about. You talked about the appeal to the youth, and I think that's really key to understand. Because in 2014 and 2019, the two elections that he ran for president and failed to do so, he positioned himself as a stern, decisive military man against the so-called quote, man of the people, that being Joko Widodo himself. In 2024, he used a much different strategy. All watchers said that his campaign strategy is very much that of an adorable grandpa image, where trying to soften his image using artificial intelligence to try and soften and make Prabowo look more youth-like and childlike, and making this whole image around him as the grandfather of the nation. And this idea that, yes, your grandpa can get grumpy, but you still love your grandpa nonetheless. So that was very much the image that his campaign was utilizing this time, largely through social media. And I think it's a strategy that has certainly paid off and appealed to Indonesia's youthful population.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Chan. It's so fascinating. As we talked about in the preview, we hinted all the way through this podcast, the transformation in the opinion poll landscape of this contest over the course of the last 6 months has been pretty remarkable. I don't think anybody, including Ganjar himself or Megawati, who was pretty instrumental in that campaign, would have expected him to not only not contest a second round of this presidential contest, but to finish in third place behind perennial second placer Prabowo Subianto and an independent candidate in Ines Baswedan. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I definitely think the PDIP themselves didn't expect that Prabowo would end up as the continuity Joko Widodo candidate, considering he was the main rival in 2014 and 2019. So I think from PDIP's perspective, I think that they would look upon this election with a sense of confusion in terms of like this was an election where, their candidate potentially 6 months ago was in a commanding position. And to finish in third place and behind Anas Baswedan, I think was just a result that not many people expected, which within the PDIP. And that does show you, isn't it, that there's a limit to Megawati's influence within the party. And in many ways, is Joko Widodo becoming a bigger player in Indonesian politics than Megawati did?
So, Chen, We hinted at the start about this disparity between the presidential and legislative election results, and actually the PDIP are right at the centre of that because you have their presidential candidate finishing in a pretty disappointing and quite distant third place, and you have a situation where actually the PDIP on the legislative side look like they will have the most seats in Parliament. I did give the asterisk that we do tend to see pretty low percentages for the winning party in Parliament, and you do tend to see pretty widespread coalition governments formed. That's why we're not going to be seeing Prabowo inaugurated until October, because it needs to give them a good 6 months nearly to bring together some kind of government that commands a majority in Parliament. But why do you think the PDIP were able to hold on to that first place in the parliamentary side, despite the pretty dismal performance on the presidential side?
I think you're looking at that question wrongly, because I think it's more why did Prabowo's coalition fracture and not vote Gurindra than PDIP significantly overperforming that? Because look at it, Sam. Granja Prabowo's ticket, the presidential ticket, got 16.7% of the vote. PDIP got 16.4% of the vote. To me, without currently having the detailed background breakdown, I wouldn't be surprised if people who voted PDIP at the presidential election transferred their votes to vote PDIP in the parliamentary elections. So I think the question is more what happened to Prabowo Subianto's coalition that caused it to splinter into so many different directions? And I think a lot of it could be due to the fact that it was clear the presidential election side who the president, Joko Widodo, was backing. But because of his status as a PDIP member, I think that made it a little bit more confusing in terms of like he was tacitly endorsing Prabowo in the presidential election, but didn't really do much in the legislative election to indicate his preference. And as a result, if you were a Joko Widodo supporter, there was no signal and the vote sprayed all over the place. And I think what we did see, therefore, is that Gurindra, for example, at 13.3%, having looked at the 2019 election, and granted, these results could be subject to change given that only 66% of the results were counted so far, it's not that much of an improvement to 2019. In 2019, they got 12.6%. It's actually Golkar itself, which has seen a big gain, which is what's got 12 point, just over 12.3%. Last time around, and it's now got 15.1%. So I think that is the question we have to ask, Sam. It's not necessarily why did PDIP overperform, but it's what happened to Prabowo's presidential election coalition that was not so disciplined in allocating its votes to
I
Gurindra
mean, you
itself.
talk about people who were Joko Widodo supporters trying to figure out where their parliamentary vote could go, but there were, even in some parts of Indonesia, there was a concerted effort to actually get those voters to decouple and be able to decouple PDIP from the Subianto, from Prabowo Subianto's ticket. And in fact, I did read that some slogans going around included things like, "We are PDIP, we are Jokowi, we are Prabowo." So trying to actually, through a slogan, bridge the gap between, yes, you can be a PDIP supporter, you could even be a PDIP member, card-carrying member, but if you support Jokowi, we can also give you permission to move across to support the Prabowo ticket on the presidential side whilst maintaining that PDIP allegiance on the legislative side. So they were actually, I think, in some places giving an open invitation to split ticket in that way. And I think that's probably why we didn't see a huge surge in the Gurindra support, because I think people did manage to completely detach the presidential candidates from their party labels. So actually what was going on was a personality-driven presidential contest and a party-driven legislative contest that people actually were able to separate in their minds, which we know is increasingly unusual in other countries around the world where partisanship seems to be spiking, split ticketing seems to be on the down low. But it seems in Indonesia, actually, we saw pretty widespread split ticketing going on in this presidential contest.
I will say this as well. PDIP and Golkar have been the parties that have been around for the longest period of time. PDIP, of course, was the party of the former president Megawati Sukarno Putri. She's daughter of Sukarno Gorka back in the day was Suharto's party. So these are the two strongest parties in terms of grassroots, the establishment with the established membership. So I think some of this better result for these two parties could be explained by the relatively better party infrastructure that these two established parties have compared to the other parties further down the ticket. And the other point I would like to make myself is how Indonesian politics, what the cleavages within Indonesian politics. I think it's fair to say that Indonesia doesn't have as strong ideologies compared to some other countries itself. So in the US is a prime example, because the ideological divide between the Democrats and Republicans are so wide, Democrats often vote down the ticket because they cannot bet. There's so much ideological differences between the parties and a fundamental core set of beliefs by the Democrats. They cannot support the Republicans' core set of beliefs. Indonesia is not necessarily the case. Political parties in Indonesia are very much run around benefits of holding office rather than ideology. So I think that less partisan ideological divide can
and
explain
that's become
it.
It's become even more stark under Jokowi as well, because he has been the presidential candidate for the PDIP, but there was no secret throughout both of his terms as Indonesian president that he was pretty flexible with his relationship with the PDIP. In fact, him and the chairperson of the PDIP, Megawati, famously did not get on, and part of their disagreement was over the kind of platform that Jokowi was espousing in contrast to what Megawati wanted the PDIP to represent. So it's for 8 years, well, 10 years, Jokowi has been playing fast and loose with that ideological position anyway. So it makes it, I think, even easier for people to play around with their votes when you have had that ideological flexibility from the party of government for two terms.
And I think, you know, cast your mind back 8 to 10 years ago, both Megawati and Jokowi needed each other. Jokowi needed a national platform to become the president of Indonesia. That's what PDIP could provide. Megawati needed somebody who was popular amongst Indonesians, and that unfortunately she worked out that she was not the person to lead that ticket. So therefore, they both needed each other 10 years ago. But the situation has changed 10 years on, where now very much is the case where Jokowi's star has grown, and you can see that and is able to spray political influences, not necessarily attached to the PDIP itself, but to subtly suggest his supporters to vote for his rival ticket as well. And you talk about Jokowi being a good example of this lack of partisan ideology divide. Look at his coalition. In 2014, for example, it didn't contain Gorka, it didn't contain Gerindra. Gorka joined the government in 2016, Gerindra joined the government in 2019, to the point where now the government controls 80% of the seats in parliament. So even though right now, sitting here with Prabowo Subianto, only securing 43% of the seats, I don't think that is a hurdle in the long term for Prabowo. He might face troubles in his first few years to get his legislative agenda through, but I don't see that as a long-term roadblock.
And actually having Jokowi in his camp, I think, will be quite important for that, because maybe Prabowo as an individual would have found it hard to negotiate with some of the parties, but Jokowi has worked now with so many of them in his two terms as government that there are those relationships there that he could help form to try and either put together a government in advance of October or put together coalitions on particular policy issues moving forwards after that.
Jen. I think what's key here is how those parties that support the Anies Baswedan will behave, because PDIP, I think, would you not agree with Sam, given how this election turned out, they, I think, very much likely will go into opposition. They went into opposition when Megawati's nemesis Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono was president of Indonesia from 2004 to 2014, and they're quite happy to sit in opposition when they didn't support the presidential ticket. So I think PDIP will likely go into the opposition camp. So therefore, I think it falls to the United Development Party, you've got 4% of the vote. There is a 4% threshold, by the way, in Indonesia before seats get distributed on an open list proportional system. They support the Ganja, but they might follow the PDIP into opposition. So therefore, I think it's the PKB, NASDEM and PKS, which are more Islamic-based parties. Two of them were ironically previously in Prabowo's coalition in 2019. I think these three parties, it's a race between Prabowo and PDIP as to who can, whether they can persuade them to join the government and reap the benefits, or Megawati being the ultimate backroom dealer in Indonesian politics, can she pull off a blocking coalition in the legislatives in the parliament? I think those three parties will be key. Do you agree, Sam? Mm.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And Chern, my final question for you on Indonesia before we move on is, obviously Prabowo is seen to have done some kind of Faustian pact with arch nemesis Jokowi for two cycles. Prabowo Subianto has come second to Jokowi. One, do you think this relationship will continue? And two, do you think Jokowi will be able to maintain the influence he maybe thinks he has now that Prabowo is heading into government? Because a lot of comparisons have been made to Marcos Jr. in the Philippines, who were heavily relying on Rodrigo Duterte's support and having Sara as their running mate.
His daughter,
exactly, as Marcos Jr.'s running mate. And since then, there's a huge rift has emerged between those two families. Duterte's influence has completely evaporated. And that's despite when Marcos Jr. entered office, the approval rating of Duterte was in the 70s. So do you think Jokowi's influence can be maintained?
Well, that's a $1 million question, and you kind of stole my point. And my answer to that question is, look what's happening in the Philippines for what could potentially go wrong in Indonesian politics, as something to look out for. I think the key difference, and there are a lot of similarities can drop between Philippines and Indonesia, and Philippines is the what could go wrong case. But I think what's different right now is that in the Philippines, you only have one single 6-year parliamentary election. In the next election in 2028, the board is wiped clean. In 5 years' time, Prabowo Subianto will be able to run for re-election. And in that case, will he still need Joko Widodo's supporters around, given images, and I suspect 5 years is not enough for people to fundamentally change their opinion of Joko Widodo? So he might still need his support in 5 years' time to win re-election. And therefore, with that potential hanging over his head, I think they will be much more willing in both parties' interest to work together rather than necessarily Prabowo Subianto doing what he actually wants to. Do you agree with that, Sam?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think the other thing that's quite important here is that Prabowo Subianto has come close but no cigar now three times, effectively, because he had previously unsuccessfully run for the candidacy, then got the candidacy twice and came second. And Jokowi was so instrumental, I think, to him being able to win an election that really should not have been his without that endorsement. I think it would be very difficult for Prabowo to...
Without his apparent endorsement.
I think it would be very difficult for Prabowo to just cast him aside, because I think Jokowi's influence is so strong, both amongst the public and amongst quite a number of parties, I think, across the parliament, that I just think Prabowo would find governing unbelievably challenging without Jokowi pulling some strings in the background. But of course, things can change pretty quickly in politics, so we'll see. It's Prabowo in the driving seat, not Jokowi, so we shall see.
And the other key difference to note is that in Philippines, for example, the president and vice president are elected on separate tickets. You have one vote for the president, you have one vote for the vice president. This in Indonesia is not the case. They were both Prabowo Subianto and Gibran Rakamuran were on the same ballot. So I think they are tied closer politically in Indonesia than they are in the Philippines, where Marcos could claim his own mandate. And I think as well, what we did see is that in the Philippines, before Sara Duterte got into the vice presidential election and formed the Marcos Duterte ticket, Marcos himself was already on track to win election. So I think he could argue that he already had the popular support and the mandate to do so. Whereas in Indonesia's case, I think why Prabowo was able to win in the first round was only because of Joko Widodo's apparent support. There was no way, I think, given the fact that ganja pirogo was posted potentially as a confusing signal for PDIP supporters and fans of Joko Widodo. There's no way Prabowo Subianto could have pulled this in one round if not for Joko Widodo's more moves that he did to signal the fact that he wanted Prabowo as his successor.
It'll be a fascinating road ahead.
So, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. As we sometimes do on this podcast, we'll all be looking at, we look back at Indonesia's general election, and I'll be looking ahead to a parliamentary election that will be taking place next weekend. And it's safe to say, Sam, it was one that probably, if you asked us about 4 or 5 months ago, was not in our radar in terms of a surprise early general election, because we covered the results of Portugal's parliamentary elections in 2022, which delivered absolute majority for António Costa's Socialist Party. And we sort of let Portuguese politics go on in the background, but it's safe to say that a lot has probably happened in the background. It has been a series of scandals and controversies afflicting the Costa government over the last 2 years or so. So much so that just 1 year after they were sworn in, the government had already had 13 resignations of 11 secretaries of state and 2 ministers. So Sam, were you surprised by the turbulence of Portuguese politics over the last year or so? And B, what was the final nail in the coffin that led to the resignation of Prime Minister António Costa?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can't not be surprised, because we talked in January 2022 about how remarkable this majority victory was, because it certainly was an overperformance of the opinion polls. It's not very typical in Portugal for a government since the formation of the new Portuguese Republic for a government to get a majority. In fact, I think it's happened 4 times now. So this was a pretty remarkable result. We were talking about what António Costa's legacy would be like, what their government would probably be able to achieve with this majority. And then the morning of the 7th of November last year, we found out that there were investigations going on and a raid of António Costa's residence. Later that morning, an arrest warrant was issued for António Costa, and in the afternoon, he'd resigned as Prime Minister. So it all unraveled so quickly that I think a lot of the world was pretty shocked to see what was going on. Now, as you did point out, the Socialist Party had been plagued by resignation and scandal throughout this relatively short majority term. So did it come as a surprise that yet another member of that government was going to be involved in a scandal? Not particularly. But did I think that we'd see the complete capitulation of the Socialist government within a 24-hour period? Absolutely not. Yeah, we've now ended up at a general election where it's all to play for, and the Socialists, I think, will be rueing what has gone on, because they've gone from being in a completely commanding position to, on the balance of probabilities, likely to fall out of government and lose the premiership. So quite a remarkable period churn in Portuguese politics.
I mean, at one point, António Costa was being talked out as the potential next EU Council President to succeed Charles Michel, or the next Socialist Blitzen candidate, given his relatively ability to bring the Socialists back and win a majority government. So it is quite a remarkable fall from grace, Sam. So therefore, do you agree with me that, do you think that the Socialists wasted this majority government and this potential opportunity, you reckon?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the having a majority government and not lasting a full term, despite not losing that majority at some point in that term, I can't think of a situation where you've gone from having a majority, not losing it, and having to bring down the government and calling another election. I can't immediately think of any other example around the world where that has happened. So for that reason, I think you can't say that the majority hasn't been wasted, because whatever you've achieved in the short period of government you've had, it doesn't really matter, because you haven't seen out the full term despite having a majority. I think so. You've wasted time, even if you've not wasted political capital, which indeed I think they have, because we're staring now at a situation where the Social Democrats, who I think we gave them a bit of a lambasting after the January 2022 election churn. We were talking about how disappointing it was for the Social Democrats, how were they in a situation where they weren't really able to remain competitive and let the socialists run away with the majority. Well, now they're the ones sitting in a position where it's looking like their leader will be heading into the premiership. So I think of course they've wasted an opportunity to be a long-term government of Portugal. What do you think?
Well, I think I can point to some examples of a government who I think have wasted it. One comes close to home to you, Sam, which is Theresa May in the 2017 election, because although these are elections in which the prime minister themselves chose to go early in order to reinforce or to get their own new mandate, and it backfired spectacularly. Not necessarily in this case in Portugal that it was forced upon them, but I think can think of three examples. Theresa May in 2017, she had a perfectly workable majority government in 2015, 2017. Her authority was unassailable. Once you lost the parliamentary election, you knew that the Brexit deal would run into trouble. So I think there's a big what if in British politics if she did not call the election in 2017. The other two examples are in Australia in 2010, when Julia Gillard took over Kevin Rudd in 2010. And Julia Gillard, I think, had opted for an election 4 weeks or something like that after she was sworn in. And it was a bad Labour campaign culminated by a series of damaging leaks. And Julia Gillard lost her majority in the 2010 election. She stumbled into minority. She formed a coalition with the Greens and essentially broke her carbon tax promise, which doomed the Labour government in the 2013 election. And the third example I'll give is New Zealand's in 1984, Rob Muldoon, who was the national prime minister at the time heading to the 1984 election, wanted another term to reinforce his mandate. But by that stage, the government had been in office since 1975. So ironically, similar situation to Portugal. The government had been there in a long time. The prime minister had wanted to call a slightly early election to, despite the fact there was no threatening to for minor parties to block confidence and supply. He wanted a new mandate, but because in his third term, the government was seen as rigid, inflexible, and unresponsive to public concerns, the Labour Party had gone into office then. So I think we have three examples there.
Do you agree, Sam? Yeah, all three of them, of course, wasted their positions. But I think the key difference here is that this was a completely self-inflicted, if not self-orchestrated, waste of a majority, because what happened here was scandals had become so bad and so endemic to the top of the party that despite the fact that the socialists offered up to Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa, the Portuguese president, an alternative government which would have commanded a majority because they had a majority of seats in the parliament, the president decided no, the appetite for a general election is too strong amongst both the public and all the other opposition parties that I'm going to force you from office and force you to have an election. And that's the crucial difference, is that public trust had fallen so significantly that I think that's the difference between deciding you want to try and get a majority yourself and having an election forced upon you because of the reputation of the government.
Well, I will argue that dissolving parliament earlier is self-inflicted, despite the fact that, so I slightly disagree with you on the definition. I think these elections are a bit more similar, but in the sense that, like, here in this case, I think, would you not agree with me, Sam? It really shows you that Portugal is a semi-executive system, isn't it? That the president does play an important role, as we have seen this time around, Sam. You hinted about it before, but do you think it was the sheer unpopularity and the sheer number of scandals and the rest of the prime minister's chief of staff and the prime minister's office being raided was only one scandal that was afflicting the Costa government? Other scandals also include the fact that the infrastructure minister, or one of the predecessors of infrastructure minister, Jorge Galamba, was named as a formal suspect following several deals when he was Secretary of State for Energy.
Yeah, I think it definitely has everything to do with the kind of scandals that were plaguing it. And I think Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa probably was privy to a Euronews poll conducted in December in the immediate aftermath of Antonio Costa's formal resignation, because of course it was delayed to ensure that they could pass a state budget. But at that point, 82.6% of Portuguese people agreed with Rebelo de Sousa's decision to call a new election. That is a huge figure of people who are clearly supportive of that decision, which I think shows that Rebelo de Sousa, I think, did tap into the public zeitgeist and the feeling around this, because all the opposition parties were demanding election, but of course they were. They're in opposition. They want to be in government and see this as a prime opportunity to get into government. But that, coupled with, I think, public attitudes towards Costa and towards the government and towards the Socialist Party in general at that point, I think probably forced Rebelo de Sousa's hand. And he thought, look, even if I agree to your two proposals at that point of a new government, because the Socialist Party had offered one cabinet led by Augusto Santos Silva and another more technocratic cabinet led by the governor of the Bank of Portugal, Maria Centeno, I think despite those two offers on the table, I think he thought, even if I agree to one of these two options, I just don't think the Socialist Party and your government can put forward a cabinet that has any legitimacy anymore, given what's gone on right at the top of the party with Antonio Costa's arrest warrant. I think he felt like his hand was forced.
Part of me wonders as well, Sam, and I'm keen to hear your thoughts about this, because it was at the back of my mind when he decided to call an early election, is that Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa, he previously was a former leader of the opposition and president of the Social Democratic Party. When the Costa government imploded, the polls were much better for the Social Democrats in terms of the fact they were neck and neck with the Socialists than 2 years ago, when the Socialists were in a much more commanding position. Do you think, and it's a cynical part of me is wondering, if any of his former political allegiances had any factor into this decision?
You think a politician might have been cynical slightly in a decision? I think that was probably at the back of his mind, for sure. But again, I think there is a like statesman point to be made here, because Rebelo de Sousa, we covered his election as president when he was first elected. He was elected pretty commandingly to that position and was trying to run a more cross-party objective campaign. And I genuinely do believe that there is a fibre of his being that has continued that objectivity in the presidency and throughout this decision. But I think, Chen, it speaks volumes that the Socialist Party have been able to put forward a new candidate, a new leader since Antonio Costa, who also resigned amidst a scandal in the last 18 months of this Antonio Costa government. So I think Rebelo de Sousa was absolutely right in his judgment that this scandal goes beyond Antonio Costa as a person, so replacing that doesn't solve the problem, because the current leader of the Socialist Party, Pedro Nuno Santos, had to resign from the government over the TAP Air Portugal scandal. So I think Rebelo de Sousa was probably correct in his assessment.
Fair enough. Just a thought that occurred at the back of my head there, but I do think you're right. I mean, you're trying to go against the will for 82% of the Portuguese people. I think that's a clear indication of what they think, what they should do.
I mean, how often in politics do you get those kind of numbers agreeing with one thing? Very, very rarely, apart from the approval of Joko Widodo as Indonesian president.
Or maybe the Queen, for example, when she was still alive. But yes, staying on Portugal, let's take a look at this election, Sam, because it is quite competitive, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the more interesting elements of it, because we've got an interesting scene set for the election that takes place next weekend, where we have, I think, a pretty consistent narrow lead held by the Social Democrats and has been for the duration of this campaign. But the Socialist Party aren't that far away from the Social Democrats. And then, of course, you have Chega, who are looking to put in their best performance by quite some distance, getting in the high teens in most opinion polls now. So I think you're going to have a situation, Chern, in all likelihood, where you have the Social Democrats and Socialists both in the mid to low 30s, Chega in the high teens, and a government has to be formed from that collection of votes. But do you agree with me that it's surprising that the socialists have actually able to continue to make this reasonably competitive? Because usually I think if your government goes up in flames in the way that Antonio Costa's did, you see the voters want to punish that. But we're not seeing a clear commanding demand for change in the Social Democrats.
No, we're not. And I think part of it is that their polling at the moment, I can see the, it's not just the Social Democrats. Social Democrats have formed an alliance with a minor, the CDS People's Party or the Popular Party to form the Alliance for Democracy, something they did in 2015 as well. They are polling about high third, low 30s, socialists about 25, 26%. I would say though that in the 2011 election, which was often seen as one of the worst for the Socialist Party, where the party was really punished after the financial meltdown in Portugal. Of course, Portugal, if you recall, Sam, was one of the pigs country. It had a big debt problem and the Eurozone debt crisis as well. The Socialists in that election in 2011 got 28.1% of the vote. So where they are polling at now, it's I would argue is near where the party's base is at. So they're kind of polling on just rely on its base voters. I think the bigger question is why hasn't all those disaffected socialist voters gone over to the Social Democrats and instead have gone to Chega? I think it does show that this is more, Chega's appeal is much more that of a anti-establishment set of policies and appeal. And both the socialists and the social democrats are really only relying upon their core set of voters, which is why this election is so competitive. I think the in more interesting question is why have the Social Democrats picked up those support?
Yeah, I mean, I think Chega is absolutely one of the big stories of this election because they're going to put in their best performance. I think it's a fact that they're going to put in their best performance. I can't see them slipping below the 7% they obtained in January 2022, for this relatively new party. And they're very likely, I think, to be a major factor in discussions around who is going to form the next government. So I think part of this conversation before I answer your question, Chen, is where did this Chega support come from? Because I think that could tell you a lot. Because if there's been quite a lot of votes moving around, if you look at the overall opinion poll figures, what it looks like is that the socialist support has completely fallen down from the mid 40s down to the low 30s. Whilst the Chega vote has accelerated. But I don't think the story is quite as straightforward as all of that socialist support has poured into the Chega camp, is it?
I do think that there is a lot of people who are angry at what Antonio Costa's government has been up to that have that doesn't that feels is emblematic of the wider political establishment. So therefore they couldn't vote Social Democrat and therefore they voted Chega. So I do think, and we've often seen, Sam, look at other European countries, is that the far right does have a strong working class appeal, which is exactly the same base as the socialists. So I do think that there is still quite a lot of movement of votes from the socialists to Chega as well. But I also wonder as well, Sam, is what is the influence of these smaller political parties, the left bloc and the communists, for example? The left bloc in particular got about 5% of the vote. The PAN, which is the People's Animals and Nature, kind of like environmentalist animal rights kind of group. What's interesting to me is that they themselves have not really benefited. They are polling in the same amount of votes as they did in 2019. So if they were ideological, left-wing ideological voters, they would have remained within that camp. But the fact they're moving to Chega, to me, suggests that there is still a large flow of votes from the Socialist Party to Chega in protest of what they view as an establishment that only looks after their own interests.
And I think Chega's campaign has been particularly effective in illustrating that because their famous poster that they've been producing throughout the last few years really is just them saying Portugal needs cleaning out. It says that in Portuguese, and then it has red crosses through the faces of figures like Antonio Costa, the new leader of the Social Democrats as well. And actually, Chern, when I was in Madeira over Christmas and when I was in Lisbon last year, I saw this poster everywhere. And that was not even in the midst. Yes, we were expecting a general election over Christmas, but early last year was just sort of midterm at this point, and you were still seeing these campaign posters all over the place. So Chega have been really running hard on this corruption message, and of course, with everything imploding under Antonio Costa towards the back end of last year, everything's played right into their hands with that anti-corruption message, because you've seen exactly what they've trying to be talking about for a few years. And yes, their party brand was predominantly built on quite contentious claims around the Roma community, around immigration, around social cohesion, and that's still there. But I think their corruption message is playing pretty strong in this cycle, particularly. And Chen, you talked about where the flow of voters is coming from. Before this podcast, I had a look back at our coverage of the 2022 election and the notes we were making. And the one thing we were talking about with smaller parties then is we thought that the smaller parties were completely drained because ultimately this contest was a battle between the socialists and the social democrats propped up by Chega. And I think you're seeing the same thing again. And maybe that's why the smaller parties are drained again, because this election, once again, is a contest between the socialists and the social democrats, who in all likelihood will be propped up by Chega. So I think if you are a smaller party voter, if you vote for the smaller parties, you're not really having a say in what will be the predominant discussion after this election takes place, which is what role does Chega play in either propping up the Social Democrats or blocking the Social Democrats and allowing the socialists to come into government? And that is the conversation. The smaller parties are not really a factor. So I wonder if we're seeing that play out again.
I think you are right in the sense that if I also think of Chega's appeal, let's be honest, the world has changed very much since the 2022 elections that delivered a socialist majority. Cost of living crisis, themes you've canvassed numerous times. We're
Yeah,
talking
I
about
mean, for
Europeans.
international context, that election took place a month prior to Russia invading Ukraine. So that's the international context. A huge amount has changed.
Exactly. And I think those messages on cost of living pressures, mortgage rate stress, all these things feed into Chega's message of dissatisfaction with the political elite, with the political consensus. And now they can add a further very powerful feather in their bow, which is corruption as well. Because I will say this, if I look at the polls since the last election, Chega's vote had been rising every single month, even before the final nail or the final implosion of the Costa government. They got a bump from that, and I maintained that bump. But Chega's rise was bef also started a long way before this whole government started unraveling by mid-2023.
And interestingly, one of their biggest increases in demographic support over the last few months has been amongst 18 to 24-year-olds, which I think is exactly what you're talking about, Chern. It's about the grim economic outlook, it's about the housing crisis. So I think it's unusual, usually, France is one of the exceptions, to see the more populist far right getting support from younger people. But in this wider picture, in this Portuguese election, it kind of makes sense in seeing that economic outlook because we know that younger people have been disproportionately negatively affected by the cost of living crisis. So that's an interesting feature as well because it was a base previously that was predominantly middle age, under 50s, men without further education. But that coalition's evolving in this cycle.
So, Sam, let's wrap up by asking our user question. I think I've got the hint of which way you would go in terms of your prediction. Am I right to say that you think it will be a social democrat government propped up by Chega? Or if that is to be the case, what kind of role do you think Chega would play? Because the far right in many different countries, particularly when they're not the biggest party like Giorgia Meloni in Italy, they have some of them have joined into government, some of them have propped the government from the outside. What do you think Chega would do in this instance?
Well, I think the Social Democrats will top the polls, and I think we will see a Social Democrat Prime Minister. But I don't know what that looks like because what I've found very interesting is the Socialist Party have even been talking about the fact that if the Social Democrats finish first, the Socialists will not work to block a minority right-wing government if that party finishes in first place. So potentially they're giving an open invitation for the Social Democrats not to have to formally work with Chega in a government, and the Socialists will not block them from doing that. Obviously, that doesn't mean that they can pass any kind of legislative agenda, because that's not saying we will help you pass your budget, we will help you pass your flagship policies. So I think the Social Democrats may ultimately feel like they have to talk to Chega to try and get something through. And Chen, I will say, this year in April marks half a century since the Carnation Revolution of 1974. And it will be very interesting, I think, in that half centenary year to potentially see a far right party back in the governing fray. And I think the Social Democrats will be very conscious of that symbolism when they look to think about what they're going to do following next weekend. When I'm pretty confident in saying I think that they will top the polls in this election. It's just what they do afterwards. What do you think, Chern?
On that last point, Sam, I know it's 50 years almost to the day since this election, since the Carnation Revolution. My only thought is that, similar to Indonesia, Sam, how much of the population remembers the pre-Carnation Revolution days? You know, a lot of time has passed under that, and I wonder about the potency of that looking back kind of memories, particularly among this generation of political establishment, particularly when the prize, which is the office and the political benefits and the office-seeking nature of parties, means that they might willing to forgo that bit of history that I suspect less of the Portugal public remember so well. So that's my first point. The second point I would like to make is that don't forget how António Costa won his last majority. The electoral system in Portugal is the haunt, and sometimes there are odd number of seats to be in a certain region. So who wins that last seat could become very key. And finishing first, like the Social Democrats could do with this alliance, could give them a boost in terms of seats relative to the pop, to the share of the vote itself. I think the ideal situation for them could be, and this is what the socialists could be hinting at, is that if a combination of this alliance with democracy and the Liberal Initiative, which is a small libertarian party, can get relatively close to the number of seats, I think that's what the socialists are trying to say. But if they fall far short, I can't see anything other than involvement, more formal involvement of the far right. I think what could be the case is that the Social Democrats' ideal scenario is that if they get enough seats and the Liberal Initiative gets enough seats, they were looking at a coalition together but just failed to get an alliance like that across the line. If you could get that number of seats to get a near governing majority, I think that's their number one outcome. I think number two outcome will have to be a Social Democrat-led, Alliance of Democracy-led government with Chega providing some kind of outside support. I don't think they'll go straight into the government itself. We saw even with the Finns party in 2015, I think it didn't work out very well when it went straight into government being so evergreen. I just think that if they want to play the long game in Portuguese politics, they might want to sit out this one and learn the ropes of government in a term, and then come back even stronger in 4 years' time.
So do you agree with me that Luís Montenegro is likely to be Portugal's next prime minister? It's just what his government looks like.
Possibly, Sam, but I will say this. I don't think either of us predicted the last socialist majority government in 2022. So, you know, as the old adage in politics, only time will tell, isn't it, Sam?
Indeed. So we'll be back to talk about it when it's all unfolded.
And that is a preview, actually, of what we will be talking about in 2 weeks' time, because we will be reviewing the results of the Portuguese parliamentary election and once again looking ahead to another early election, this time in Tasmania. And as always, we'll continue to bring up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at @ballot_talk. And please do leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us. You can also email any feedback or comments to ballottotalkabout@gmail.com. My name is Chen Han, and until next time, we will speak to you soon.